This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the first time. The First Time Podcast has a newsletter. It will go out monthly-ish. To sign up, go to our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com, and click on the Sign Up to Our Newsletter link.
Hello, Catherine.
Hi.
What shall we talk about this episode?
Well, not to flog a dead horse,
no.
But events are a bit of a running theme we've had. So I did think, why stop now?
Why stop now? Tell me, which types of events?
Earlier this year, over summer, a library contacted me.
Ah, yes.
And it was not a Melbourne-based library, which would have been a pretty straightforward
negotiation,
I suppose you'd call it. It was a regional library.
Uh-huh.
It's about 5 hours out of Melbourne.
Ooh.
And so they said in the email, do you do events and can you give us an indication of how much you charge?
Excellent. Let's make a note. Excellent on the libraries sending out that email and asking how much you charge as opposed to just anticipating that you'll do the event for free.
Well, it was, and just nice getting an email out of nowhere is pretty cool.
Absolutely. Too. They want you. They like me. They like me.
But the question was, how much do I charge?
How much do you charge, Catherine?
Well, I emailed you, but you were also away.
I was away. I was at the beach. I didn't see the email. I was useless.
Yeah, useless to me. I emailed a couple of other people. Everybody was pretty useless. It was the height of summer. And I eventually got on to Jacinta, and she said, quote, the ASA rates.
Yeah.
So ASA, Australian Society of Authors, and they have different rates for a one-day session, a four-day session, and an hour session.
Yeah.
So that's $350 is basically the rate for an hour session. For an hour session.
Yeah.
And then I thought, but this place is 5 hours away.
Mm-hmm.
So I just said in the email, $350 for the 1 hour plus some sort of travel allowance.
Sure. And what did they say?
Well, then I spoke to, so they didn't immediately respond.
Okay.
And then I ended up speaking to Jane at text.
Yeah.
And she didn't know that I'd responded at that point, but she was like, well, you really wouldn't want to go down and back in one day. You probably want to try to stay overnight.
Sure.
So then I emailed the library and said, I've already said about the travel, but I'll probably have to stay overnight.
Sure.
So I hadn't actually quoted an exact figure, but at this point it's looking like $1,000 for them to get
suddenly
me.
The library's like,
no. So I, in the same way that you're waiting to hear on various submissions, I'm still,
waiting to hear back from the regional library. You're welcome to contact us, regional library. We'll, you know, we can talk further about this. It's tricky, huh?
It's so tricky.
It's really tricky.
I don't know. Like if it was Melbourne, I would be, you know, or even Geelong. Like I've been down to Geelong and done library events there.
Yeah.
It's not far.
No.
I don't care about travel time. I don't have a charge for those.
Yeah.
Which in some ways is kind of unfair that I would then charge a regional library that.
It's true.
That 1 hour.
But you have to think about, you know, what's the cost benefit for you? So if you're going to a Melbourne library for an hour after you've already done your full day of work, which you've been paid for as an engineer, then that makes sense. If you have to take a day off work to travel, you know, like you can't do it. And then also you resent it. So if you were driving down, you know, and five people turn up, which is what sometimes happens in libraries as well, you know, that's tricky. I think you were absolutely right to do that. I always put a link to ASA rates. I think we've talked about this before in the podcast. It's important for our colleagues that we're all kind of trying to charge the same thing. Sometimes libraries have little buckets of money that they've got for other reasons. So I've sometimes been booked and been paid $700 for a library session because that library had a particular bucket of money and I happened to be on the list at that time, you know, but I would never expect to get paid that all the time. That was just lucky. And I've done lots of free ones as well. And sometimes I do free ones because it's my local library and it's not an event that is being paid, like if I'm hosting. Although something that I've recently been asked to do, I did do pushback and I said, you know, we all need to be paid at least this amount of money.
So what had you done events for them previously?
Yep. And this time, and I've done this with some schools as well, said, you know, I can't afford to get an honorarium of
$100. Do you generally get paid by schools?
Yes.
When you go in?
Yep. In that first little bit, I sometimes did freebies and, you know, depending on the school and my relationship with them at various times, I will do things for schools, but I always now quote the ASA rate and I send an invoice for that amount. And if I am doing it for free or for a discounted rate, I put my discount on there so that the school can see that that is how much you charge for that event.
Because this is a discussed topic on Binders as well. I've seen a few posts where people have said, and sometimes where people have quoted different rates and almost had pushback from the whatever institution it is saying we can't afford to pay that.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, some
copies of your book or.
Yes. And that's the other way that you can look at it. Another way for regional things might be to then arrange, well, can I go to the three bookstores in town? You know, a couple of years ago when we were visiting my sister in Broome, and it was the year that the book came out, I did an event at the school, I did an event at the library, I did local radio. The publisher helped me, but I kind of organised it myself. I knew I was going to be in Broome, so I did it that way. So, that you know, that's another way to make it worth your while, I suppose, as well. Yeah, tricky.
I have another type of event.
Go. Give me the other type of event.
What's your take on book clubs?
Oh, book clubs.
Mm.
Let me be straight up honest here and say I've got a book club coming up that I'm doing because it's a friend. And the only other one I've done is my parents' book club, which was very amusing and where I was interviewed.
So your parents actually in
My parents book are club. In a book club. It's their local neighbourhood one. And I was, given a pretty hardcore interview in front of everyone by someone who had interview experience and they did not necessarily go easily on me. But there was wine and cheese involved and it was my mum and dad's book club. So all in all, it was rather lovely.
Like how hard did they go in?
Pretty hard. Yeah. I mean, it was a good experience because it was the same kind of hard that I ended up getting at festivals, et cetera. But, that's another story. Tell me, have you done a book club, Catherine?
Well, I've done a couple now. Okay. Which have all been friends of friends.
Yep.
Say I've done 4 book clubs. It's funny because I actually spoke to you and I spoke to a couple of other people before I sort of said that I do the book clubs and they all sort of got lined up quite quickly and hit. Sort of that bit was probably a bit unfortunate. They hit in very quick succession.
Sure. What do you like about doing book clubs, Catherine?
I think the thing about book clubs is that the book clubs that I've gone to, I would very happily be a participant of the book club.
Sure.
Very nice people.
Great conversation.
Good conversation.
Good bottle of wine. Good,
exactly. Yep. Like a good kind of grouping together of things.
Sure.
Generally all women, you know, have a few drinks or dinner or, you know, this kind of thing. I don't want to go as an author.
Are they asking you questions?
That? Well, or I kind of am hesitant to say that because I really liked the people that were there.
Yeah.
But the structure of it is it's different to a book club or some sort of event run through a bookshop or something like that. Because they're often very unstructured.
Yes. So you might get caught between like the cheese plate and first course or something and then just.
And I kind of did a couple of times.
Oh, so weird.
They vary in size. So you sort of. People might be half eating their dinner.
Yes.
And then remember that you're there and sort of say maybe.
Yeah.
Well, that bit was funny.
Yeah.
Which is not really a discussion.
No. So we need rules. I think there need to be rules. So the rules of engagement.
The
around,
main rule.
Yeah.
Is, which has worked really well for me, is to say, I'll come for an hour.
Great. Yes. And do you, are you saying, that. I'll come for cheese? I'll come after dinner?
Well,
I'll come before
I would
dinner?
I'll the pre-dinner.
But sure.
I guess because they're often women. That was the other thing. I don't really like going out in the evening. They're often post children's bedtime.
Yes.
That, which is a good, convenient time for people. Yep. But the time that I am really winding down.
Sure.
I come up early.
Yeah, you are always up early. You put me to shame.
Yes.
You know, the other thing that I think you can do, and I had forgotten about this, but that I've done quite a number of times, is I've known that my book was being discussed at a book club.
Yep.
And I haven't gone, but I've answered questions for them in advance and sent them. And then often they've sent me pictures of the book club, or that's all really lovely
Someone
stuff.
Someone did contact me to see if I could send them questions, which I intended to do and then completely forgot.
But I, you know, I think that that's another way that's, you're not kind of putting in your awkward thing.
A nice hybrid
and
sort of option.
Yeah. Because what we know is so lovely is people reading our book, people passing it on, word of mouth, and the idea that they're sitting around discussing it, like, that's exactly what you want. It's just because
it's
it
just
doesn't have the festival
there.
Structure or, as you're saying, a bookshop structure.
I would say in one or two, that was the harshest criticism.
Yeah.
As well, which is in a small space.
Yeah, that's pretty tricky. We also, did you see, this was recently on Twitter, people were talking about this. Did you see what, I'm pretty sure it was Natasha Lester who put it up, but people can correct me if I'm wrong, where she talked about going to a book club where they had only one copy of her book. They had photocopied it multiple times and they all had photocopies.
How do you photocopy it? Like 300 and something pages?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But also it came out in this Twitter thread that like one of the women's partners had it photocopied at his work. So like clearly it's not that they can't afford to buy the book. And also the time, I mean, like that's ridiculous. How could you even...
Wow, that's the work experience kid.
Yeah, the work experience kid has... So I think that people at book clubs need to know the behaviour expected of people at book clubs.
A lot of people had library books, which I think is great. I'm a big, I read a lot of books from libraries, but I signed one.
You signed
which
one?
Which now I'm having an existential crisis.
Okay, tell me about how you signed one.
Well, all the books, so there were a few books that I was signing for people and then someone picked up one and was like, oh, you should just, whose is this? Just sign this. And I was like, oh, it's a library book. And she was like, just sign it. Just sign it.
I love it.
So I signed it.
If you are the library branch,
Burundara Library,
that copy of the helpline with the signature on it is actually Catherine's signature. It's not that a kid has scribbled in it and you don't have to take it out of circulation. That's the real deal. You can put a sticker on the front of that one. Will you be going to book clubs in the future?
I would through a bookshop or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. Come back to me. Or I would do it as a twosome, to be honest.
Oh.
If you went with another author friend, that would be a good scenario.
Okay. If you're a book club and you want Catherine and I to come to your book
club. No, don't say that. No.
Are you sure?
She's eat those words back up.
I take that back. We might just edit that part out. This week, we speak to writer and critic James Bradley about broken books, writing climate change, and unexpected bursts of publicity. James Bradley is a novelist and critic based in Sydney. Born in Adelaide, he trained as a lawyer before becoming a writer. Bradley's novels have been published internationally and have won or been shortlisted for a number of major Australian literary awards, including the Age Fiction Book of the Year, the Miles Franklin Literary Award, the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards, the Commonwealth Writers Prize for Best First Book, and the Courier Mail Book of the Year Award. Bradley has also published poetry and essays, edited anthologies, and is widely published as a critic, with reviews and articles appearing regularly in Australian newspapers and magazines. Bradley's most recent novel is The Buried Ark, the second in his dystopian YA trilogy, which began with The Silent Invasion and will finish this year with The Vastness of Stars, due out later this year. Welcome, James.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Thank you for coming. It's very exciting to have an interstate author with us.
James, the glamour.
I know, the glamour in our little studio here. We always start our interviews talking about first time. So I want to ask you, can you remember the first time you ever saw your words in print?
As an adult? Yeah.
Yeah.
I wasn't someone who always wrote. I started writing when I was in, my last year of university. And I started writing poetry. And I'd always read a lot of poetry and read a lot of stuff. And I started writing poems. And There used to be a thing in Adelaide called Friendly Street, which was a long-standing community poetry thing, and people went and read, and every year they published a book, and they, you know, there was a kind of publishing program associated with it. And I went there and read some poems, which went quite well. And then I bundled up it was probably like the six poems I'd written, and I sent them off to magazines, and Southerly bought two of them and a story that I'd written. Yeah, so it's full
money, first time publication,
but the full like gambler disaster where it's like you kind of go, maybe I'll write some poems, maybe I'll send them off. I sold them, and I reckon it probably took me like 2 years to sell anything else after that. But it was. Yeah, it was incredibly exciting, but it was weird because it was so long ago now, and it was in the days when you had to photocopy everything and send it with envelopes so they could send it back to you, and then you'd look at the mailbox every day for like months waiting.
Do you think that was a better time in that sense? There's a romanticism that I think about that kind of idea.
No.
No.
I think it was better. It's funny, I was just reading a review of Sylvia Plath's letters, and they were talking about exactly that, about her sweating on letters all the time. And it was the letters from the publishers that never came fast enough. It was the letters from her mother that always came after she'd already spoken to her on the phone and she knew everything about them. The lovers who didn't write in time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, but it is very different, that kind of, I think we forget how close that kind of time of a completely different kind of communication was. When I mean, long distance phone calls interstate were incredibly expensive. Yeah. No one made them. And this is only, what, 25 years ago, 30 years ago.
Yeah. The times.
The times.
Tell me, James, from there, so you get this instant kind of success and cash. I'm actually doing the cash signs with my hands. But at this stage, you're still training to be a lawyer. Like, did you suddenly decide, okay, that's it, I'm going to give this writing thing a real red hot go?
Oh, look, I don't know. I went to university and I studied philosophy and I studied law, and I never knew what I wanted to do. I was pretty confident. I thought for a while I'd be a philosopher, and then I decided not to do that. And I didn't really want to be a lawyer, but I didn't know what else to do. And one day what actually happened was two things kind of converged. I read, this can sound really strange, but I read Michael Ondaatje's In the Skin of a Lion. Mm. And it had this, like, a really profound effect on me, where I remember thinking, suddenly I was reading a book where the way the writer saw the world felt to me like the way I saw the world. And that kind of moment of recognition was really important. And over the next few months, it kind of occurred to me that, well, I always felt I'd seen the world a bit differently to everyone else I knew. And I'm sure we all think that, but I in my blasé 20-year-old way, I thought I did. And I guess somewhere along the way, I thought, well, if someone else could write a book that was about all of those things, I could write a book about all of those things. And so that happened. And then I started writing poems, I think partly because I used to read a lot of poetry and because they were short and manageable. And it was really odd because I'd never wanted to do anything. And that was always one of the issues. Like, I didn't really want to be a lawyer. I didn't really want to do anything. And suddenly I thought, I really want to do this, you know. So I don't know, it was like literally I started and thought, I love this, I want to do this. So
your first collection of poetry, Paper Nautilus, was published. How did that come about? Was that you pushing them out, or did someone then offer you a...
No. That was I think I'd published a few things in literary magazines by that point, and I possibly had finished a novel, because I entered a novel in the Vogel and lost to Helen Demidenko. I think I must have seen that they were publishing that new poet series, and I think I put in a manuscript.
Okay.
And they took it, and it was actually a really amazing experience. I mean, quite aside from the idea that you've been published in a book, which was incredibly exciting, they sent me away to work with... mostly with John Scott, the poet. And I guess he and the other people at Five Islands I worked with made me think about all these things I'd never thought about before. You know, like, how do you manage poems over page breaks? Where do they sit on the page?
Yeah, wow.
You know, and just practical stuff like that I guess I'd never really thought about. And that was a really, really amazing experience. And the book itself, I don't know, I mostly stopped writing poetry almost as soon as I'd published it. But I always really loved that book, and I loved the poems. So
you talk about working with people at Five Mile Press. Was that your first entry into a writing community? like that? Had you been part of those kind of writing communities before?
It was Five Island, actually, not Five Island, Mile. Sorry, I think I said Five Mile. I guess I had been a little bit in Adelaide because I'd met some people there, and then I'd left Adelaide by this point and was living in Sydney. And I don't suppose, I don't know that I really knew any other writers in Sydney. My partner is a writer as well, so there was kind of the two of us. But I don't know that I was really part of a community. So probably it was the first time I'd been part of that kind of professionalized kind of community. And I found it really fascinating. We did a whole lot of events together because there were six of us. And we did all of these kind of group readings and things like that. And that was all, it was actually, it was a really wonderful experience. And kind of fascinating for me because I suppose all of that stuff you write right at the beginning, you write with a kind of innocence. I mean, that might sound odd, but it has a kind of, it's not messed up by having to think about the world.
Yeah.
And so when I look back at those poems now, they look to me often like the best thing I've ever done.
Mm.
You know, that kind of, there's a kind of...
less self-consciousness.
Yeah, and a purity to them, you know, which I like. Which is not to say that I think that they're outstanding as poems, but I think they have almost a carelessness or a confidence about them that I find really exciting to look at. On those rare occasions, I go back and look at them. I do it all the time, obviously.
Yeah, that's how I spend our days.
Yeah, I spend my days reading my old books.
James, you went from there and quite quickly after that, you published your first novel, Rack, and you were named a Sydney Morning Herald Best Novelist of the Year. How does that set you up for the rest of your writing, that kind of success early on?
Oh, look, I was really lucky because I came through at a moment when there were, as there is again now, I think, a kind of generation of younger writers with a, you know, I don't know that there was a similarity to our work necessarily, but a lot of us knew each other. We kind of came through as a group, you know, so there's people like me, Delia Faulkner, Christos Tsiolkos, Nick Earls, like a whole kind of group of us came through at one time, Andrew McGann. And I suppose it was also a moment when there was a lot of excitement around Australian publishing and around Australian writers, which was really great. And so that was really fantastic to be part of. I mean, I think all of that stuff, I don't know, there's a weird level at which it never feels real. Mm. You know, it's lovely, but it's an odd process. And in fact, in the end, because the first book, both the first books had good responses. And when I came to write the third, that got in my head in a really bad way where I started kind of thinking, oh, look, I need it to be better than the first two, you know. And I suppose there was a level of expectation I put on myself, which did neither me nor the work any good. So.
You've written about, this is the writing of The Resurrectionist.
Yeah.
And you've written about that on your blog. And it's quite extraordinary to read the piece where you talk about the novel kind of literally coming undone in front of you. It's such powerful imagery. And I think very worthwhile for people to read. We'll link to it in our show notes. How did you get through that stage? Can you tell us a little bit about that process?
I was writing the book and I guess it all came unraveled, you know, in the way books sometimes do. And I think I'd kind of fixated on it and I needed, you know, it wasn't, I mean, I think it's very difficult when you're writing a book and the book comes apart because you're so tied up in it. And all books come apart at some point. There's always some point in the middle where they come unraveled and you think, I'm never going to be able to do this. But that one came unraveled and stayed unraveled. And I kept writing it again and writing it again and it just wouldn't fix itself. And I think it was, yeah, look, I found it was very difficult. And I guess I eventually, oh, and various professional things went wrong as well. But it all came to a point where I just thought I've got to stick it together and make it work. And I remember I left it alone for a while and I went back and managed to finish it and sent it. In fact, sent it to a friend down here in Melbourne and she looked at it and she said, you know, it needs various things done to it. And she said, I remember her saying, you understand it's a very confronting book. And I said, oh, no. And she said, there's all this stuff with dead bodies and, you know, people murdering people. And I'm like, oh, really? Like, you know, I remember having that weird thing about stuff you live close to and you don't understand what it is to other people. And so, yeah, so I guess that process of putting it back together was extremely difficult. It's funny. It's a weird book. And I actually quite like it, how it ended up, because it's got a kind of brokenness in it, which is sort of deliberate. It's sort of, in a sense, what happened in the writing of it, I think, has ended up in the book somehow. And I don't know if I'm, perhaps only I can see that, but I quite like that quality of it. I also accept that it's not a book that's for everybody, if that makes sense.
It was published internationally and went very well. How did you make sense of that, I suppose, a book that kind of nearly was broken and nearly broke you, then going out into the world and becoming this great thing?
And was declared unpublishable on several occasions.
Yeah, right.
By publishers and agents. That book. Well, look, what happened was it sold here, and then it sold in the UK to Faber, and then it ended up on, there used to be a thing called Richard and Judy, which was, I don't know, like Mel and Koshy.
Yeah.
And they, except without Pauline Hanson, and they used to do a book club. And this book club, it was in fact how Kate Morton's kind of success in the UK came, because she was on it twice. And so what they do is they choose like six books, I think it was twice a year. There was a summer set and a winter set, and then they'd feature the books. And so it ended up on that, which got the celebrity reviewers Benedict Cumberbatch before he became incredibly famous.
Oh, my goodness.
And the whole thing was totally insane. And I went to London for 2 weeks to sort of do the stuff around it. And it was just this...
So did you know it was coming? Like,
oh, yeah,
no,
I knew it was coming.
You knew it was coming.
And in fact, what happens is the publishers used to put in books. I think it's like lots of these things. So the publishers put in books and they wrote to me and they said, oh, we're putting your book in. And you think, oh, it'll never get through.
Of course.
And then they write back and they say, well, there's a shortlist of 12 or 15 or whatever it is. And you're on the shortlist. And I was like, oh, wow, that's amazing. You know, and we'll know. And it was such a big deal for them. And they said, oh, and we'll know on this day at this time. And we'll email you as soon as we know. And I remember thinking, because there was another book by an Australian writer on the list. And it was historical. And I just thought, you know, they're never going to choose mine over that one, you know. And so, in fact, in the morning that they'd email me, I didn't even think to check my email until about 10 o'clock in the morning. And then I discovered it had gone on this thing. And then it was totally berserk. Like, it was like the number one bestseller. And, yeah, I mean, I'm not the kind of writer that kind of thing happens to. Does that make sense?
Like, absolutely.
I don't write the kinds of books that those things happen to. So it was just an extraordinary experience. Like, I mean, although I remember going and watching the show, and I watched it. We didn't go to the studio. We watched it in the Faber boardroom. And we were sitting in the Faber boardroom with everyone sitting around watching this tiny little television that they had, which had this kind of disapproving bust of T.S. Eliot up above it. And I'm thinking, here you have a metaphor for contemporary publishing. We're all sitting around watching the daytime television hosts talking about books while T.S. Eliot looks down on us.
And because we know now that that is the stuff that makes the difference, right? Have you done anything as berserk in terms of publicity as you did with The Resurrectionist?
No. And I mean, I do think that stuff around books is really interesting about what makes them sell. Because, I mean, there's obviously a thing where things can be hyped and they can sell. And there is a thing where, you know, there are certainly, if they've got a celebrity name attached to them and things like that, often they'll sell. But the thing that really sells books at the end of the day that works, I think, is word of mouth. And if people like books, you know, they give it to the next person and say, I really liked this book. So that kind of why it is people like the books is a really interesting question. But, you know, at the end of the day, the sustainable kind of success comes from people liking the books, you know, and then they like them for all kinds of reasons.
Absolutely. Lucky they do, so that we can all get one up.
There's lots of room for lots
There's
of different
lots
kinds
of
books.
There's lots of room for lots of books. Going back to that idea of this kind of broken book in the middle there, and I loved the way that in the interview that Charlotte Wood did with you in the writer's room, she introduces it by talking about the fact that you've had these kind of two acts in your creative career, in your creative life. And I don't know, perhaps there's now been subsequent acts as well, but I wanted you to see if you could just comment on that, and particularly for our listeners who might be starting out, this idea that a creative career that spans hopefully a number of years.
You're suggesting I'm old.
You've actually managed to get not only the second book, but the third and subsequent books out as well. How do we do that? How do you sustain yourself? How do you get through those broken parts and back up again?
Because everyone has those broken parts, you know. And I've got a friend who will remain nameless, but who had published several books, had an unbelievably successful book, and then spent, you know, 12 years torturing himself writing the next one, you know, and it was an appalling process. But that was about him, you know, he that massive success was wonderful for him, but in fact ended up being a kind of burden on him because he didn't know how to replicate it. You know, how do I catch lightning in a bottle a second time?
Yeah.
And I think that makes it very difficult. Look, I think creative careers are odd things. I think they have ups and downs. I've got a friend who talks about the threadbare tapestry. But I mean, I guess the thing that matters is that you care about the work and you continue to care about the work. And the thing I would say over a number of years is that there's different kinds of work you do. So there's work you do which is to make money, you know, and that kind of work, the trick is to find ways of doing that you feel okay about and that are sort of emotionally and financially sustainable. But then there's the work you really, you know, which is the kind of work of your heart, the work, the books and essays and things that matter to you. And with them, I think you need to follow what you want to do, you know, and I think you also need to accept that doing that may not result in various kinds of success. I mean, at the end of the day, you've got to come back to the work and why you care about it. I also think something happens where, and I think it's particularly true with writing, where when you're 25, there's a series of things you say, I don't care if I never have money. I don't care if I never have financial stability. I don't care. As long as I can write, I'll pursue that kind of romantic dream. And I think once, and you know, I've now watched a lot of people do this, and I've done it myself. Once you get into your 40s, you start going, actually, being broke all the time isn't so much fun, and I've got kids, and you know, it's all a bit difficult, really. And do I really care about, you know, what matters to me? Do I care about the work that much? Or, and I think finding a way to balance those things is really important, and often quite difficult. And I think, you know, I've seen people who've made different decisions about that. About ones who've gone, well, look, at the end of the day, perhaps I've written the three books I wanted to write, you know. But then other people who say, well, look, I'll just keep on going. And I think that's a really, you know, it can be really difficult from time to time. But I think if you enjoy the work, and you've got to enjoy the process. So I'm rambling on here, but I mean, I think one of the things I'm very aware of is I don't usually like the end product, you know, and particularly when it first comes out. So if I look at it, something from 10 years ago, I think, oh, that's actually not bad. You know, someone quite okay wrote that. But anything I've just written, it comes out and I just think, oh, I can't even bear to look at it. And I think what that means is unless you're going to feel really miserable all the time, you've got to care about the process over the product.
Yes.
Does that make sense? You've
it
got
does.
To find the pleasure in the process and in feeling that you're doing something you care about.
That's interesting. I heard Cara Duendovi speak last year and she said similar, you know, she just has to have it away from her. She can't bear to look at the finished product. And she also talked about the tricks she had to do to enjoy the process along the way as well.
Well, and I think that's something that happens. I mean, I think you need to find ways of, I don't think the process gets any easier as you do it more times. I think Which is so unfortunate. What I do think happens is that you become more aware of what the pitfalls are. And so when you're feeling unbelievably miserable because the whole thing's unraveling, you can say to yourself, I always feel like this.
Yeah.
And it now doesn't stop you feeling miserable, but allows you not to feel like it's the end of the world. You kind of think, well, I've got to go through this process because I always go through this process of thinking this is a disaster.
Mm.
You know, this is never going to work. I'm never going to get there. And I think also you develop some strategies. So certainly with long bits of nonfiction, you know, I have strategies these days about, you know, writing pieces of them. If I can't work out how to do the whole thing at once, I'll write pieces that I know I'm going to have to write and then you Frankenstein it together, you know, and at some point it becomes a thing. You know,
can you do that with your novel writing as well, or is that something you do more?
look, I think you learn to write differently once you have children. And as anyone would tell you, I think you learn that you can't go and spend 6 weeks working in a creative frenzy. You have to learn to write in little bits and pieces. And I certainly with Clade, one of the things I did, because I'd had a number of books that had fallen over and one that I'd finished and not, in fact, withdrawn because it wasn't right. Between the Resurrectionist,
it wasn't right for you.
It wasn't right for me. To be honest, I don't think it was right for them either. But they just kept saying it was. But
it's still
no. In fact, I looked at it again the other day and was thinking, oh, terrible zombie projects. I don't know what I think of it. It had a problem, and I couldn't work out how to fix it.
Okay.
it also had, was kind of powerful. It's a strange book.
Okay.
It's, I mean, it's like The Resurrections. It's a weird book that I think doesn't necessarily work. Does that make sense?
Yep,
but
it
has
does.
A kind of energy. And then I wrote a series of other novels which just, and they kept falling over. So I'd get about 10,000 words in and I'd get terrified and think I can't write this. And so I must have started about 6 books.
Wow.
And, yeah. And so one of them in particular was really good. He says modestly. One of them was actually, I thought, really good, but I just couldn't work out how to do it, you know. And I couldn't make myself break through that barrier you get to at about 10 or 20,000 words where the book, you have to start making hard decisions and I kept getting the terror. And so I had an idea for this book, and once I knew how I was going to do it, I kind of wrote a plan, and I knew that there were going to be 10 or 12 sections, and I knew what about half a dozen of them were. Like, I knew where it began, I knew where it ended, I knew a couple in the middle. And I remember once when I was teaching, we had Margot Lanigan in, and she talked about writing...
Sea Hearts?
No, the one before Sea Hearts, which I'm completely blanking on the title of. Doesn't matter. It's a fantastic book. The one with the dwarf.
Yes. No, I've got...
I'm completely blanking on the title.
Right.
It's a wonderful book.
Yeah.
But she, weirdly enough, had been in a very similar place. She'd been writing a book that had fallen over. She'd completely lost her belief in her capacity to write novels. And she said she said to herself, well, I can write short stories. So what I'll do is I'll write a short story, and then I'll write another short story, and then I'll write another short story, and at some point I'll have a novel. And I kind of did the same thing. I said, look, I know what 6 or 8 of these sections are. I'll write them, and then I will trust that I'll work out what the other bits are. And I think teaching myself to do that again was really important, because as soon as I'd written Clade, I've written a number of other novels, you know, and there's something about getting back to a point where you trust yourself to find your way. And I think that's quite a difficult... I think if you lose that trust in your capacity to find your way, it's quite hard to get back.
You teach creative writing as well.
A bit, yeah.
Do you try and pass that on, I suppose, to the students and the writers who come to you, that there's going to be these individual stuck moments and individual ways of getting through that?
Yeah, I don't do a huge amount of teaching anymore. I do a bit of mentoring, which I actually really, really enjoy. And one of the things I really enjoy about it is that you actually see people improve. Like, you feel that you really, like, you feel that you're delivering something. And I like that sense that you can help. I mean, I think the thing I would always emphasise to any, and in a weird kind of way, I think all teaching is a bit like this. It's about saying, you know, at the end of the day, they've got to do it for themselves.
Yeah.
But what you're doing is making it possible for them to feel it's possible
and
showing them some tricks along the way to help them get there. But an awful lot, I think, of what you're doing is just saying, just write the next
Keep
bit.
Keep going.
Keep going. And then that's kind of the solution. Just write the next bit, because the answers are always there in the work. They're not out there. They're there in the thing you're writing. And so no matter how bad it is, writing another chapter will be better than sitting and worrying about it. Because probably at the end of the chapter, you'll think, oh, okay, I worked out that thing that I couldn't work out how to work out.
Mm. I want to go back to that idea about you not wanting to look at the work when it's finished. And there was an interesting thing that you have on the blog. It was about the process of writing The Resurrectionist. And you said, anyone who writes and has had to speak publicly about their work will be familiar with the process of creating a comprehensible story to encapsulate what the book is about and how you came to write it. And it just, that whole section resonated with me, because Catherine and I have talked at length about this idea that there's the book, and then there's the narrative that has been created about the book that you then have to go out and perpetuate, and that you mess up, or you suddenly go back. And this time around, in writing my second book, I journaled the whole thing, because I was so upset in the first case that I had got so many facts wrong about my own process of writing the book. So how do you deal with that now? Has that become easier for you, or have you got another way of kind of thinking about it?
I did a doctorate a few years ago, and one of the things that was really weird about it was I used a novel for it, and in fact, the one I was talking about before.
Yeah.
And I remember when I had to come and do the dissertation next to it, going back and thinking about how I'd come up with the idea, and once I actually started digging down into it, I realised that almost everything I thought about how I'd started writing the book was wrong. Like, it was like I'd read this book and then I'd read that book, or these things had happened and none of the dates added up. And I just thought, this is the narrative I have in my head about this is completely false. And in the same way that you can write great slabs of things in the drafting of a book and completely forget about them, like, you'll find them on your hard drive and you'll go, here is like 30,000 words I wrote that I have no memory of. When I was writing that book, and I must have cut it out at some point, and somehow your brain's just written it out. Look, I think that process, certainly when you're doing the public stuff, and I think like a lot of writers, I find a lot of that quite difficult, and I find all of the stuff about talking about my work quite difficult because it's a very private thing and it's a very personal thing, and I'm very wary of, I don't like the idea of explaining the work. Like, yeah. I think there needs to be a kind of, the work needs to speak for itself. So I can speak around the work, sure. but I don't want to explain to people what it is. And also because you worry that if you do that, you know, it'll be like pulling the curtain away and finding
yes,
Oz
well,
sitting there pulling the levers.
That's part of it, breaking that first magic.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that first magic, that's a great term. That first magic is incredibly important, that kind of mysterious, ineffable thing that kind of holds a book together, and you don't want to mess around with that. So, I mean, I guess certainly in doing the public stuff, you learn quite quickly that you need to find a way of talking about your work and a way of being in public as a writer that lets you feel both that you're being relatively honest, but simultaneously that you have a level of distance, I guess, you know, that you are managing that interaction. And it is really strange, all of that stuff. So I wrote a few things about 10 years ago, about depression and about a series of things like that, which were extremely personal. And I can't talk to my partner about that stuff.
Mm.
I couldn't talk to my friends about it. I could stand in front of 500 people in a hall and talk to them about it, or
isn't
I could write an
so
essay
strange.
About it.
Yeah.
But, you know, but I mean, I remember getting up and talking about it, and it was kind of fine because I was in control of that process. And I suppose when you're talking to somebody that you know, you're not in control of the process.
No.
So it's all about control, really.
Well, and deeply vulnerable yeah. in that space.
But where... but it's funny, isn't it? So I remember writing particularly one of those essays and it being published, and I was quite okay with it being out there, but I could not have talked about it. My father, in fact, read it and was very upset by it, and I couldn't talk to him about it. You know, like it was, you know, but that slippage between, I guess, that kind of version of yourself and the way that you manage the revelation stuff in public and you is quite different. You know, I mean, it's a very odd process.
You write personal essays and that kind of nonfiction that's published widely. Have you ever made a decision where you've written something and then said, no, that's just not going out?
Yeah, look, and I mean, and going back to the idea of teaching, one of the things I'd always say to students is that you should write the thing. What's that great Colin Toyban line about writing unless if your mother's dead?
But,
you know, I mean, I'd always say to them, write the thing you want to write and you don't have to publish it.
Mm.
You know, and I think there's certainly things I've written that I've thought I'm not going to publish. And the flip side is, it's funny, really. I wrote a story a few years ago, which was half of it was highly autobiographical, the other half was not. But the highly autobiographical stuff, I used all of the real people's names. And I remember in fact, I remember my friend Georgia Blaine, before she died, wrote a novel where she used all of her friends' names and then she forgot to change them. And it was too late by the time she suddenly went, oh, I haven't changed the names, like, from my real friends, you know, which was all a bit of a disaster for her.
It
was a very Georgia moment. But but yeah, I remember writing this story and then looking at it and thinking, I can't do this. It's defamatory aside from anything else, you know. And so I changed all the names, and I remember... the minute I took the real names away, the whole thing just kind of, for me, it lost all of its energy.
Yeah, interesting.
It was a really weird moment. So I thought, oh, you know, and I presume whatever energy it had for other people was not lost by the changing of the names because they have nothing associated with those names. But it was
done for you.
Gone for me.
You have recently, and we've just talked about this because you've got a new article coming out in the New Monthly with the incredible cover about coal. You also were nominated for a Walkley last year for your essay in the monthly, The End of the Oceans. How do you go about tackling those pieces of nonfiction where you're writing about the natural world, climate change? This is something that you've written about in your fiction and your nonfiction. How do you keep your head above water? How do you cope with the aftermath on, you know, when you start getting heckled and worse on Twitter and in public? What's the process for you?
I'd like to pretend the big heckle doesn't worry me, but I don't like it at all. I have a very odd relationship with social media, and I find all of that stuff about people going you on social media, I shouldn't admit this, but I find it actually really, really difficult.
Yeah.
And I find all of the capacity for misunderstanding really difficult. Like, I don't like that thing that happens where people misunderstand what you've said,
mm-hmm.
or you upset someone without meaning to, you know, which I've certainly done. I tend to do that in my personal life as well. But But I mean, I think with those big things, particularly in environmental things, and they are quite difficult to write. So the ocean one was very much about taking a whole series of things and lining them up so people had to look at how bad it actually is. You know, because I think with lots of these things, people don't think about it or don't let themselves think about it because it's so overwhelming. And so it was pretty overwhelming to write. I guess when you're writing it, what you're really focused on is trying to write the thing. So you're focused on all of those kind of technical and creative challenges rather than the material. But when you step back and look at the material, it's very difficult to cope with. I mean, I think the thing I try and go back to is one thing I'm always struck by is that when you talk to scientists particularly, I wouldn't say that they're hopeful, but they're very focused on, you know, most of them are hysterical, you know, but they are not rolling around or paralyzed by grief. What they are doing is working on things.
Yep.
You know, they are focused on solutions. They're saying, well, look, 90% of the coral is going to die in the next 10 years, but we could save this 10%. Yep. You know, so let's work out how we save that 10%. You know, and so that kind of focus on solutions and on doing things, because I actually think action, I think, you know, actually doing something is the real antidote to despair. You know, you can only do as much as you can do, you know, but, and it's one of the things I find a bit, one of the things I don't like about that social media environment is all of the kind of performative stuff.
Yes.
You know, and I look at people and I think, well, if you feel so bad about it, do something about it.
Do something. I was actually going to say that, like, and I can't quote it to you because I haven't got Twitter in front of me, but I really recall reading the article, being profoundly moved by the article as many people were, and then watching as at some stage you got back onto Twitter and said, and here's what to do, because you were clearly watching this kind of outpouring of grief and hopelessness and people saying this is terrible and sharing it, but feeling paralyzed. And I think that paralysis is catchy too. So you obviously came back on and realized that.
Yeah. And look, I mean, I think, you know, it's like writing books, you know, it's like the solution is in the doing, you know, and I mean, it's one of the things I find a bit, you know, the situation with climate change is very, very bad. But having said that, you know, there is a big difference between us ending up at 4 degrees. There's a big difference between us ending up at 2 degrees, you know, and at 1.5, you know, and I suspect we'll overshoot 1.5. But, you know, the trying to find a way of actually translating your sense of despair into action is really, really important. And there are ways of doing it. But, I mean, as I said before, it's a bit like writing. You find the thing you can do. It's better to do something than to do nothing. Do you know what I mean? And if all you do is go and say, I'm going to give money to Greenpeace every month, that's something.
Go
and do that, you know. But, you know, vote. Like, I mean, do all of that stuff. You know, do. And it is that thing about kind of social action, is that it happens because people decide to do things. They build alliances and they go and talk to policymakers and they go and say, you've got to do something about it. You know, and we've managed massive change before. We can do it again.
Do you feel like putting your energy into nonfiction, those pieces for the monthly, for instance, is the best way to do it, rather than putting your energy into things like Clade or your YA trilogy, which tackles the same kind of material? Or is it the combination of both that works for you and works for getting a message to people? Or is it not about a message? Message is a hard word.
Message is a hard word.
It is a hard word.
Look, with that stuff, I think I'd be a pretty crap activist, you know, and I think I don't really want to go and get on the bus and go up to, you know, Carmichael. You know, and that's for a whole range of reasons. But what I can do is write, I think, reasonably well about it. You know, I'm a better writer than I am an activist. Does that make sense?
Do you not consider your writing activism?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, yes, that stuff I would consider a form of activism. But I do think I'm better at doing that than organising. Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I think I can contribute more by doing that. I see the two processes, the fiction and the non-fiction, has been complementary.
Sure.
I think at the moment things are moving so fast, and so much of what needs to be done is actually just getting people to think about it, and getting people not just to think about it in a negative way, but to think about it in a positive way. These are what the solutions might be. You know, these are what some of the solutions might be. That actually writing that kind of shorter form non-fiction, so not books but articles, is something where, I mean, I don't know if it ever achieves anything. Maybe it does. I don't know. But, you know, I feel like it's something where you are actually, there is some chance you might you might do something. I don't know.
I think that it definitely, your words obviously resonate with lots of people and are making a difference in one way or another. I wanted to touch on your work as a critic. You had a great quote, and I'll link to this, where you were talking about criticism. I think it was in an interview you did. You said, you're talking about us in Australia. You said, not only are we lousy at criticising something or somebody without attacking them personally, we're almost incapable of interpreting criticism without treating it as a personal attack. Should have given you warning on that one. I loved, again, going back to the Charlotte interview, she says the first time that you were in contact with each other was when Charlotte contacted you to say how useful a review that you'd done of her work was. And it was the first time she'd ever kind of felt that she could move with that criticism she'd received. How can we deal with criticism better as writers?
That was very gracious of Charlotte. I don't think it was it wasn't a negative review, but I think it was perhaps not an entirely positive review.
Okay.
It was many years ago now.
Sure.
I'd like to be better at dealing with criticism. I don't like it when people criticise me. I think that there is I get really frustrated with the constant, recurrent rather than constant, conversation about we need more negative reviewing. We need more, we need harder reviewing, by which people mean, critical writing, which kind of eviscerates something, and given that we all have a different view about what should be eviscerated, that seems to me to be, a difficult thing. And sometimes that can be a really fascinating process. So there's a fantastic review, I think, in Book Forum this month of the Bret Easton Ellis memoir, which you may or may not have read. If you haven't read it, go and read it.
It
is unbelievably savage.
Okay.
And incredibly funny.
Okay.
And a fantastic piece of writing.
Yep.
And that's kind of useful, but you don't want a critical culture that's like that all the time. I mean, I think what we need to do is to find a way of, you can read. So Dwight Garner's a fantastic reviewer. And I remember reading his review earlier this year of the final volume of The Canal's Guard, which is, what's that fantastic line in the middle of it? It's so boring that light bends around it, but you come out the other end thinking, I actually want to read that book.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it now, because what he does is he illuminates it. He argues through it. It's a kind of really high octane piece of kind of critical writing, which is simultaneously very funny and very negative. It would be horrible to be on the receiving end of it.
Sure.
But it's kind of useful, and I don't know, I'm very wary of, one of the things I always loved about blogging was that kind of conversational thing. So you could just talk about things and you didn't feel you had to reach a kind of judgment about them. So you could say, well, this works, that doesn't work, that's interesting about it. And I really love that process. So it's like talking to friends about a book, where you can say, look, I didn't think it really worked, but I loved this thing about it. I thought that thing was really fascinating. I thought that thing they were pushing at there didn't really work. I want critical writing to be interesting, but I also want it to illuminate and connect and, I guess, kind of help us understand things.
James, what advice can you give for a first-time author?
My advice would be really simple. It would be write the thing you want to write, believe in the thing you want to write, and don't let other people get in your head about it, but also to accept that, the process of a career and the process of writing is a process, and that what you see from the outside when you see other people's, the books kind of emerge out of people's lives, but what you don't see is all the stuff that's around them, and that often a book, it's taken them 10 years to get there or 3 years to get there. And so I think all of that stuff about just keeping on going is really, really important. You write the next chapter and you enjoy the process of writing the next chapter, or you take satisfaction, perhaps enjoy is the wrong word, you take satisfaction from the process of writing the next chapter, So, I think it's that. I think it's, don't let the world tell you what the book should be. Write the book you want to write.
Excellent advice. To finish up, can you recommend for us a debut novel, any debut novel, any time, any place?
That I've read recently?
It can be recently.
Buddenbrooks. No.
I failed to give James a heads up about his debut recommendation. So he's currently scrolling through his Goodreads and he's just now recommended about 40 books to me that I need to read. James, can you recommend some recent books you've read that we should all go out and read to become better readers and writers?
Become better readers and writers. I reckon some of the books I've loved recently were, I've just read Lanny, the Max Porter book, which is wonderful as a kind of piece of writing. It's extraordinary, but it's a piece of, I guess, that kind of observational thing about people's voices. It's fantastic. I think there's a Sigrid Nunez book, The Friend.
Yes, on my TBR pile.
Wonderful. It was one of those books that I sort of didn't, you know, I had to be taken
coerced
there.
Into reading. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I really, really loved it. And two more. A book by Audrey Shulman, which no one had, I'm sure many people not have heard of, which is fantastic, which is called Theory of Bastards, which is about bonobos in the future. What could be wrong with that novel?
Great.
And I've just read, although it's not fiction, Sophie Cunningham's new book, City of Trees, which is kind of, it's fantastic. But it's fantastic in that it's a really clever blend of things. But what's fantastic about watching the way she incorporates the process into the book. So it's this kind of peripatetic book that moves around. And it's quite unassuming in lots of ways. And conversational, and then it gets you to this place. It's just incredibly powerful and intellectually really, really interesting. I thought it was a really fantastic book. So
that might go to the top of my TBR pile. I love Sophie Cunningham. Thank you for those recommendations. And James, thank you for sharing your insights and wisdom with us today. It's been a joy having
you. Thank you very much. It was great.
Okay, James Bradley, for your first time, were you agented or unagented?
Well, it depends a bit on what you mean by my first time, but if you mean my first novel, yes, I was agented.
Agented. Have you stuck with the same agent?
No.
Okay, interesting. Another story there. Advance or no advance?
I knew there was an advance, but I remember discovering afterwards, like, everybody else's advance had been about three times what mine was.
Damn that. Overseas territories or just Australia and New Zealand for your first novel?
First novel, overseas.
Festival invites or no festival invites?
Yes, and I was dreadful. When I did my second book, I got taken around by a publicist, and when I did my first radio thing, I came out and I said, "How was that?" And he said, "It was dreadful."
Oh, no.
And he told me, he said, like, you know, "I'm going to tell you how to do this from now on." And I then got like 5 minutes of the best advice I ever got.
What was the advice? Quick, give it to
us. Oh, it's really easy. He said, "You need to know what you're going to say before you go in." He said, "You need to go away and write 5 paragraphs that you want to say about your book, and you need to learn them, and then you deliver those 5 paragraphs in some version every time."
Excellent advice.
Which sounds really like, and it's just, you know, it was the best advice anyone ever gave
me. And you've done that since?
I don't know if I've done that exactly, but certainly.
It worked.
I got, it stopped me wandering around, as I have throughout this entire podcast.
No, this is a wandery type of a place. Mm. We like that. And James, do you know, and are you willing to share with us, how many copies you sold of that first novel?
The first one, I don't know off the top of my head what it sold overseas. I think here it sold 25,000 or something.
Amazing.
But it's also kept on selling because it's been on like school syllabi and things.
So we love the schools.
We love that. although the schools result in less sales than you might think. So it's trundled away. But it's interesting. I think sales are so interesting because you hear other people's sales and you're like, oh, they're so much higher or much lower than I thought they were going to be.
That's partly why we ask it, because it's been, you know, revelatory. And then we have also talked about going, we should never ask that question. It's a terrible question to ask.
Most people answer it?
People who are more experienced. People who have got more books out and who are further away from their first time, I think are happier to answer it.
It's terribly difficult these days because, I mean, sales are down so far from where they were. Well, simultaneously, they're down and up.
Yeah.
So if you are, like, that middle's dropped out of the market, which is incredibly difficult, because that's where most of us live.
Yes.
You know, so the people who were selling 50,000 now sell 10.
Yeah.
You know, or they sell
100,000.
500,000.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, there's no, well, they don't sell 500,000 Australian. Maybe they sell, you know, 70,000 or 100,000. But it's still, you know, that middle is gone, you know. Yeah. And first book sales are so small now. Yeah. And I think that's incredibly difficult for writers because, you know, you're not economic to a publisher.
No.
You know, and that's disastrous. You know, David Malouf used to say that the best thing that ever used to happen to writers was that they got to publish several books before anyone noticed.
Ah, yes.
And so people only really took notice of you when you got your third or your fourth book, whereas these days you've got to get
that
the first
really
one right,
changed, hasn't
or else
it?
You're done. Yep. You know, well, you're not done, but, you know, I also think that's one of the things people do is they put that on themselves about, you know, if this fails, I'll be I'll be done. But I think you need, I also think you just can't worry about that stuff. You can't affect book sales.
We can't do it. We are going to get this second book done, Catherine, if it kills us in the process. James, thank you so much.
All right, thank you for having me.
For more on James Bradley and his work and for show notes for this episode, head to thefirsttimepodcast.com. And please let us know if you liked the episode by sharing or giving us a rating wherever you listen. You can get in touch with us as well via Twitter or Instagram at thefirsttimepod. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first and second time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe Ady. The First Time Podcast is supported by Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, RMIT School of Media and Communication, and by our wonderful supporters on Patreon. You too can become a supporter of our podcast by heading to our Patreon site, www.patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast.